As a child, I was in a play of Noah's Ark at the local Jewish community center. I was cast in the role of the wife of Shem, one of Noah's sons. The biblical text doesn't bother to name the wives of Noah and his sons, and so apparently our playwright wasn't going to either. But that's another sermon about feminism. It wasn't until the set construction phase of the production that the meaning of the story really sunk in. We painted huge columns of swirling water with splashy brown blobs to represent all the creatures of the earth dying watery deaths. Suddenly, the plot struck me as hideous. All in whose nostrils was the merest breath of life, all that was on dry land died. All existence on earth was blotted out. This was utterly incompatible with the spirit of love that my UU minister called beloved, a term for God she must have borrowed from the Sufi mystics. If God was such a jerk, and I could think of no other word for behavior like that, why would we worship God? Wouldn't we struggle against such oppression, just like courageous people have always battled tyranny? Sadly, the play failed to address my theological turmoil. This is how it went. The ark got built, the rain fell, songs were sung, it was a musical. Most people remembered most of their lines, and then the flood stopped, and voila, rainbow. We had even painted another side of the death and destruction column with lovely rainbow stripes, so that it could be turned and revealed as a finishing flourish while we took our bows and our parents clapped. How did we get from mass murder to a clear sky decorated with a sparkly rainbow? Well, according to the text, it's because God remembers. And when the waters had swelled on the earth 150 days, God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God caused a wind to blow across the earth and the waters subsided. What does God remember that halts this campaign of terror? I think it may have been the memory of an earlier chapter in which God was actually the one who started all of this, who created the earth and all living beings. Maybe what God remembers is that initial divine plan for harmony and diversity and beauty. But the plan went awry. People misbehaved, and so God threw a temper tantrum. And then what? God remembered or regretted or grew up? Can the divine evolve like that? Certainly, God's promise-making ability evolves and matures, because the covenant itself changes. First, God said to Noah, "Everything on earth shall perish, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark." But by the end, God makes a huge commitment, much bigger than a conversation only with Noah. "Never again will I doom the earth, nor will I ever again destroy every living being." What began as a small, and I would say stingy, promise, "Many will suffer, but I will exempt you, Noah, and just a few," became expansive and included everyone, every being. It might help us to remember that all this happens in Genesis, at the very beginning of a pretty long, epic scripture. Maybe God wasn't very mature at the start. As we sang in our opening hymn, "Young, growing God, eager still to know, willing to be changed by what you've started." That is so human. It is often said that we are created in God's image, but humanism reminds us that it is also we who create God or spirit or however you name the unnameable. We create God in our own image, in imitation of our own limitations and gifts. We have many limits, but at our best, we have the humility to be changed by what we've started. We can't control or contain life, but we can engage it. We can learn from it and grow in response to it. And humility is necessary to be able to do that. It's not a question of changing all the time, whichever way the wind happens to blow. It's more like being ever open to that which is truly ultimate and ultimately important. In our reading, God's ultimate, I think, was the earth's continuity. Seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. We too have our own ultimates. In my life, I felt called to activism as a very young person, knowing myself as someone willing to be stretched and challenged for the honor of participating in a thrilling, heartbreaking, complex world. I'm not saying I've always known how to do that. I often don't still. But the calling itself is deep and insistent. When I grew up working at an options counselor, working as an options counselor and medical assistant at a nonprofit feminist family planning clinic was perfect. I just knew that this was my calling. It fit my politics, it gave me a way to contribute, and it shaped my worldview in ways for which I am profoundly grateful. But then I also found that secular activism, like the reproductive justice movement, but also beyond, was too often fueled by the desperate fear that change wasn't actually possible. This kind of mindset is understandable, and I succumbed to it myself on occasion. But it fails to see humankind's ultimate capacity to be changed by the world. Recognizing that as one of my ultimates, that I believe in the possibility of change and in the ultimate worth of evolving with a changing world, prompted my entrance to the ministry. I was changed forever by what I had started. Emily Pearl Kingsley is also someone who knows about what is ultimate. A longtime writer for Sesame Street since 1970, she is often asked about life with her son, Jason Kingsley, who has Down syndrome. According to her, it's like this. When you're going to have a baby, it's like planning a fabulous trip to Italy. You make your wonderful plans, the Colosseum, the Michelangelo David, the gondolas in Venice. After months of eager anticipation, you pack your bags and off you go. When the plane lands, the stewardess comes in and says, "Welcome to Holland." "Holland," you say? "I signed up for Italy." But you've landed in Holland, and there you must stay. It's not a horrible, disgusting, filthy place. It's just different. So you must go out and buy new guidebooks. And you must learn a whole new language. And you will meet a whole new group of people you otherwise never would have met. It's slower paced than Italy, a lot less flashy. But after you've been there for a while and you catch your breath, you look around and you begin to notice that Holland has windmills and tulips, even Rembrandts. I think it's easy to approach parenthood or any other life experience with specific expectations, even if we're not aware of them at the time. But who knows what will actually unfold? Clinging too tightly to a plan that no longer fits your circumstance can shrink your life, rendering you unable not only to evolve, but even to enjoy life at all. If you spend your life mourning the fact that you didn't get to Italy, you may never be free to enjoy the loveliness of Holland. In contrast to Emily Pearl Kingsley's beautiful attitude, the backstory of our opening hymn, number 23, Bring Many Names, is somewhat of a cautionary tale about how not to approach opportunities to be changed by what you started. Written in the 1980s by Brian Wren, Bring Many Names was inspired by the Reimagining Community, which is a radical feminist movement in Methodism. Not only does this hymn refer to a strong mother God, but it also asks us to consider God as old, aching, and then as young, growing, which seemed to some to deny the timeless, eternal nature of the God of more traditional interpretation. Even though the people tasked with assembling the official United Methodist hymnal in 1989 specifically asked for music from a feminist perspective, Bring Many Names was excluded because of its questionable theology. From my perspective, this should have been a slam dunk. Here was a new, more whole understanding of the divine, conveniently already set to music. Well, that's great. What next? But instead, it was institutionally prohibited. Unitarian Universalism has been happy to embrace this scorned hymn. But that doesn't mean that we're perfect. Humility requires us to recognize that we, too, have sometimes missed the boat on greeting change gracefully. However, I do think that the capacity to start something new and then let it permeate and transform you is actually something this fellowship does well. I'm often asked how I knew this congregation was so special, and I have lots of reasons, especially the search committee members, and especially Roger. But a moment of clarity was talking frankly with the search committee about how this fellowship understood change as it relates to growth. Growth is partly a numerical phenomenon, of course, but in my interview we discussed growth as an increase of spirit and energy, as well as numbers. And we named the importance of letting vision lead us forward, because growth is also about being open to being changed. That sounded like a place I'd like to be. More recently, a longtime member here told me that years ago, he could tell new welcoming practices were succeeding because all of a sudden there were people around whose names he didn't know. Now, he could have responded to this change by grumbling about lack of parking or complaining when he had to sit by someone he didn't even know. I've heard people complain about that in other congregations. But he didn't do that. Instead of hunkering down and resenting new folks for the great crime of being new, he decided to always remember to wear his name tag. By supporting the new hospitality plan to begin with, he had actually helped launch this cultural change. And then when it did introduce change into the congregation, he let himself and his behavior be changed by the process. He was open to being changed by what he started. Congregations are not the only communities facing change, of course. For example, the post-election analysts have been very busy lately discussing the changing racial and ethnic demographics of this country. In these conversations, fear is often expressed, and sometimes that's indirect and subtle, but sometimes not, that people of color and immigrants are going to take over. The implication, of course, is that these people want to take over the normal people, right, and what is normal code for, who actually belong. Even people who live in a primarily white cultural context, and I include myself here, people who work with mostly white people, who live in mostly white neighborhoods that interact with mostly white people, we are having our eyes increasingly opened to the reality that this country, for the first time since European colonization, is getting less and less white. According to the 2011 census, racial and ethnic minorities currently, and this is for the first time, make up more than half the children born in the U.S. In Appleton, the 1980 census told us that 98% of the population was white. By 2010, this number had fallen to 85.2%. People of color are now almost 15% of the population here. And that's a huge demographic shift in just 3 decades. Children experience this more vibrantly, as the minority student population in Appleton today is about 24%. I don't know exactly what these changes will mean for me personally, or for the fellowship, or for the Fox Valley area at large. I do know that we will have to decide, individually or collectively, whether or not we are willing to let the evolution of our world change us. However you came into this world, whether it was in Appleton or elsewhere, you started life in a complex, diverse world, and it is getting more so. Increasingly, we will have to choose. Do we want to remain in the present, even as it becomes the past, even as it requires increasing closed-mindedness and grumbling about parking or sitting next to someone we don't even know? Or are we, individually and as a community, willing to be changed? I hope that we can learn to see shifting demographics as an ultimate invitation to metaphorically wear our name tags, to embrace a stay wherever the flight attendant announces we have landed. My friend and colleague Joel Gilbertson White puts it this way: the world is changing, and I'm on the transition team. God doesn't come to us fully formed. We create the divine, and so it changes as we do. I know that I'm not alone in imagining some ultimate force of evolving love, who rather than damning us by flood, would instead be symbolized by that rainbow. If I were the director of theater at the Jewish Community Center, and I'm sincerely glad I'm not, but if I were, I would make that the most important scene of the play, not the isolation and devastation of a bullying God, but a divine rainbow that promises inclusivity and reminds us always of change. May this fellowship be a place where we practice what it could mean for us to change the world and be changed by it. May it always be so.